And it is 1 p.m. I'm calling the meeting of Health, Finance, and Policy to order. And there is a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for the April 8th meeting?
So moved.
Representative Perryman, thank you so much. Moves approval of the minutes for April 8th, 2026. Any discussion on those minutes? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes of April 8th, 2026 are approved. Our first bill we have for consideration today is House File 4712. And Chair Dibble, will you make a motion to put Representative Schultz's bill before the committee?
DePell.
Did I say Dibble? I'm so sorry. DePell.
Mr. Chair, did you say chair or did you say representative?
Future chair.
Representative Patel, will you make a motion to move Representative Schultz's bill before the committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you there, Representative DePell. House File 4712 will be laid over. We have the bill before us, Representative Schultz. Welcome to the committee. Does this save anything? Tell us about your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have a DE2 amendment to get it in the shape that I would like, if someone would be willing to move that.
Representative Perryman, would you like to move that DE2 amendment?
I so move the DE2 amendment.
Representative Perryman moves the amendment labeled as DE2. Representative Schultz, share us about the DE2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This DE2 gets the bill in the shape that I would like it. It is to address a very small challenge that has emerged with regards to our public pool limitations that we have. And this is the amendment that I have been working closely with both the advocates for this bill in addition to the Department of Health. And this is the form that we have gotten it to today and very, very close to its finality.
Okay. Representative Perryman has moved DE2. Any further discussion to the DE2 amendment? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The motion does prevail. The amendment is as adopted. Today we will be hearing from one testifier, but before we do, I'll speak to your bill as amended, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the members of the committee for hearing House File 4712. This is a bill, again, that is very narrowly focused to provide an additional exception to the public pool limitations. So honestly, it's a little bit similar to one of the times I was before you last year with regards to the hot tubs. But this bill in particular has to do with certified swimming classes, and in particular, a group of very, very highly certified swimming instructors that help our youth, that help infants, that help those with developmental disabilities, and to ensure that they have the access that they need to the types of pools that will allow them to provide this in Minnesota. To my knowledge, there are only two of these specific instructors at this moment in time, but our desire, and I think the more that you all learn about these instructors, the more that you're going to want this here in Minnesota, and other states do this as well. So this is an emerging training and certification that helps more Minnesota kids be safe in the water, whether that's in a pool, whether that's in a lake, or on a river, experiencing the best that Minnesota has to offer. So I would appreciate your support of House File 4712.
Okay, thank you. We have one testifier. We are limiting that to limit it to 90 seconds. We have Teresa Septit. I think she's online.
Hello, yep, I am here. Tessa Septit, yep.
Go ahead, please. State your name and share your 90-second testimony.
Well, good morning and thank you very much for your time. My name is Tessa Septit. I'm a certified ISR instructor who works with infants as young as 6 months old on up, and other young children, including those with a lot of developmental delays and medical complexity needs. What is ISR? We're a specialized method of training kids for water and safety and survival, not just strokes and water acclimation. ISR is built around preventing drowning. Stay calm, don't panic, control your breathing, float independently until help arrives. For many of these families, it's the developmental delays and medical complexities that they have no access. The access is the barrier, not the willingness. Traditional facilities often can't safely accommodate children who need warmer water, quieter environments, flexible scheduling, individualized
30-second warning.
Or as a result, they cannot have these lessons. Basically, the children who are the most vulnerable are often the least served. But we are looking for private pool use because we cannot find facilities able to adequately facilitate us.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Is there anyone else in the audience that would wish to testify on House File 4712? Okay. I'm not aware of any other amendments to House File 4712. We see Representative Hewitt. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz, for bringing this bill. I think it's a great idea. However, I do have some concerns, not with the instructors or anybody like that, but actually being into drowning scenes myself. I am concerned that when we're using non-commercial situations, that the egress for people that work in my space are not going to be able to get there, get to the people, get their stretchers through, get their equipment through. Have you put any of thought into that as you're crafting your bill?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While that has not been a specific consideration that I have considered, the testifiers could provide you in detail, potentially in a private meeting, just to explain what one of these facilities would look like as an addition essentially to their home or to their property so that you could better understand that to that specific Representative Hewitt. But further than that, the other thing that I want to point out for you is that this bill is quite clear about the navigation of the child or the person who is learning and the instructor. It's one-on-one care. So that individual who's providing the training is right with that individual, which in part, in my belief, would assist us in ensuring that that person that is getting trained is well cared for.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm sure the chair himself knows that one-on-ones are great. We have them all the time in the back of an ambulance, but one-on-one doesn't mean the person's going to not collapse or do something. This individual person, the lifeguard, is going to have to go get help at some point and take the person out of the pool and continue along with other things. And so I'm not opposed to your bill. I just think we have to put more fail-safes in it. I mean, if there's a panic button by the pool, if there's something like that, and I guess that you're open for suggestions here, and it's not, again, trusting that the individuals that I know that go through a lifeguard class, and this seems like more specialized training, have that training if something happens, but the real activation is of the 911 system, and that is so essential to any kind of pool setting that they get help on the way so we can actually continue the care. So I like to think that you're thinking about it. I'm sorry I didn't get to you before this, but it just came up as you were talking about it. So, Mr. Chair, I thank you for letting me make my comments, and hopefully the bill gets more in shape of the concerns with public safety in it.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Schultz. I also kind of like the idea, and I hadn't heard about this, but the instructors and all that, it sounds pretty exciting. And I'm glad you've worked somewhat with the Department of Health on this, because obviously pools are, as we just heard, you know, this is a dangerous thing. And I'm just wondering, will the folks who do this carry insurance? So, and will the insurance be impacted by the fact that it's not being examined, you know, tested by the department and stuff like that, so that, you know, in the I'm sure rare case where there would be any sort of injury to someone, that there would be some, you know, these kinds of injuries can result in somebody needing, you know, a lot of care. They can be really expensive for a person injured, and I just want to know that that would be covered in the rare eventuality there would be a problem.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling. That is certainly something that, I can research deeper, potentially even with you more specifically. But if I'm just recalling actually our conversation from a year ago, it's that when folks are in business, they need to carry levels of insurance for this sort of thing. But I will follow up in addition with the testifiers and the advocates for this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, hearing no further discussion, House File 4712 will be laid over. The second bill we have for consideration today is House File 4801. Representative Nadeau, would you like to move House File 4801 to get it before the committee?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. House File 4801 will be laid over. We have the bill before us, Representative Nadeau. Tell us about your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You know, this bill is about aligning all of our healthcare partners to get on board to reduce waste, eliminate fraud, and coordinate care. The goal of this bill is to address the gaps in the commercial and Medicaid policies and add capacity to identify, prevent, and mitigate fraud and waste in our healthcare marketplaces. Every provider I know wants to do the right thing, but the complexity of our healthcare delivery system has loopholes and without consistent attention can result in increased healthcare costs. The approach this bill takes is to detect, close loopholes, stop fraud, targeting prior authorization, utilization review, aligning MCO and DHS communications, and credentialing providers. And I am going to go through the bill, as is my practice. Section 1 and 2, this proposed update allows for retrospective reviews, reducing the need for prior authorization and adding a post-service validation. This approach streamlines the experience for patients while enabling plans to identify patterns of fraud, waste, and abuse through data-driven audits. In-network provider contracts, and this is important, in-network provider contracts prohibit patients from being billed for retrospective denials if medically necessary criteria are not met. Section 3 of the bill provides limited flexibility for plans to establish prior authorization to services that exceed established standards of care. When a provider seeks to deliver a higher volume or intensity of service than clinical guidelines support, prior authorization with additional information from providers for treatment or when that treatment changes occur would confirm that care is appropriate for the patient. Section 4 updates Section Statute 62M07 and addresses gaps identified during the implementation that we put in place in 2024. The edits made to this section clarify that approvals for short-term or curative treatments are not intended to be indefinite. And I think at this point, I think we have to remind the committee and the audience that prior authorization is really not only about care provision as much as it's about providers being paid for that care. Section 5 describes conflicting services and adds a new subdivision to address situations involving conflicting or duplicative services. This subdivision provides valuable insight when multiple providers unknowingly deliver overlapping or incompatible treatments and support, that will support better care coordination and improve health outcomes. Section 6 is a data sharing component. This requires DHS to share suspected fraud reports from that come from a managed care provider across all Medicaid managed care organizations to strengthen early detection and increase visibility into suspected fraudulent entities. Section 7 is about networks. MCOs were pushed to use DHS provider lists for housing stabilization services. This section adds a layer of protection allowing managed care organizations the authority to verify and approve a provider's legitimate credentials before adding them to its network in accordance with the current laws for timely provider credentialing. Section 8 requires DHS to include risk corridors in MCO contracts. DHS implemented retrospective risk corridors during COVID to ensure that MCOs were not overpaid as utilization was low and they clawed back capitation payments in 21 and 22. These risk corridors must be symmetrical, they must be two-sided and uniform for all MCOs and include a settle-up process that occurs within 6 months of the end of the plan year. One of the main reasons for the financial problems and insolvency of UCARE was insufficient capitation payments in 2024 and 2025. Collectively, I want to remind the committee that MCOs lost $571 million in 2024 in the Medicare and Minnesota Care population. As a result, DHS added risk corridors to the contracts for MCOs. This section makes those corridors permanent. This provision provides financial protection to the state and to our managed care organizations. This language was recommended by CMS, and it mirrors the risk control language in the 2025 CARMA legislation for county-based purchasers. Risk corridors are in the 2026 MCO contracts, and this language would once again make it permanent. And with that, I would like to move to testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. We have two testifiers, and they should be in person. We have Dan Enterson and then Katie. So, Dan, if you can go first, you are on deck, and then Katie afterwards. Please state your name, and would ask you to keep it to 90 seconds, please. Go ahead, Dan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. The goal of HF 4801 is to address gaps in program integrity in the commercial market and MA program that can result in fraud, waste, and abuse. Even though most providers are doing the right thing, there are providers out there that use loopholes to their financial advantage to the detriment of patient care and result in increased health care costs. Health plans are situated in a space to be able to see broad areas of the health care system and can identify fraudulent trends. All of our plans have special investigation units who employ financial auditors and have staff with backgrounds in law enforcement. Credentialing, contracting, prior authorization, post-payment audits, record reviews, and site visits are just a few of the tools health plans use to prevent and address fraud, waste, and abuse. House File 4801 will address three areas our investigation teams have flagged that will improve program integrity in the commercial market and MA program. As was mentioned, this includes changes to the 2024 prior authorization law to ensure that services being billed are the same as the services being delivered. Improving communication from DHS to MCOs when credible allegations of fraud are shared, and preventing and preserving an MCO's ability to credential providers in the MA, in MA, and perform the necessary background checks. Passing elements in House Bill 4801 will ensure all entities in the healthcare system are working together to ensure Minnesotans are receiving the care they need while staying alert to the bad actors looking to exploit important programs. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. State your name and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members. I'm Dr. Katie Smentek. I'm the chapter president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I'm also a practicing general pediatrician in Mankato. This bill would introduce more prior authorization in Minnesota, the number one cause of physician burnout. To some health insurance companies, this looks like a way to restrict access to care, shift decision-making away from health professionals altogether. To me as a pediatrician, prior authorization is a five-year-old with asthma who can't get their inhaler refilled and ends up in the emergency room struggling to breathe. It's a 14-year-old diagnosed with major depression, waiting weeks for approval while missing school and falling deeper and deeper. It's a 10-year-old with epilepsy who starts having daily seizures again because the medication it took years of medication trials to find is halted, because this previously approved medication must be re-reviewed while paperwork moves through the system, something that will happen again if this bill becomes law. These are real patients of mine. The bill introduces broad concepts like whether care exceeds a standard of treatment or involves conflicting services. In real pediatric practice, those terms are not straightforward. Children rarely fit into rigid categories. Their care is collaborative, evolving, and individualized. The decision about their care shouldn't be made by an insurance representative, but by the doctor and the care team who know them best. Prior authorization only delays care and leads to worse health outcomes. That means unnecessary long-term consequences of chronic disease and escalations to emergency-level situations. I urge you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here today and sharing your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 4801? Okay. I'm not aware of any amendments to House File 4801. Is there further discussion on this bill? We have Representative Hewitt.
Could the doctor come back up, please?
Go ahead, Representative Hewitt, with your question for the doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Doctor, for your participation today. I'm just curious, would you happen to have an approximate time spent when you... Now, what I understand is that on these pre-auths, it has to be you that deals with them. It's not like you can't, I'll have my staff deal with this or whatever. So you have to take time away from your schedule to actually sit down, document this, talk to somebody and wherever they're calling you from. Is that true?
That is true.
Yep.
The average number of hours over all specialties is about 13 hours a week.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hewitt, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so that's time away from patients. And with that, do you have a story you could share with us very briefly about how you have had to work with a patient that you're waiting for a pre-authorization, it didn't come back, and that patient ends up inside the ER that night or the ER down the line while you're still waiting for pre-auth? Do you have any story you could share with us real quick?
Yeah,
go ahead, doctor. Well, we go through everything through the chair so they know on recording. Go ahead, doctor.
Thank you. I am happy to elaborate on that story of the 10-year-old who had epilepsy. He had had it since infancy. We had tried 12 different medications until we found one that controlled their seizures. Their parents received a letter that that medication would no longer be covered by their insurance company. And so we had to be on the phone for hours. We had to write letters from specialists. We had to find a world expert to write a letter saying that there wasn't another medicine that would be useful for this patient. Mm-hmm. And all the while, their parents were on pins and needles, thinking that they were going to go back into status epilepticus.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, one last follow-up.
Go ahead,
and
please.
I appreciate you, your diligence here, Mr. Chair, but I just want to make a quick statement. As we all heard about in this committee, mm-hmm. and I've known through my own profession, that the most expensive care you're going to get is going to happen in an emergency room, and that's just the way it is because hospitals have to pay for readiness. To have our patients that are waiting on a pre-auth, I don't understand why the insurance companies can't come together on this and look at, you know, when. And I know that we already say you don't have to get a pre-auth for emergency care, but it's a lot cheaper to deal with this in the forefront. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for your diligence.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I really want to be very kind about this, but I'll be honest, I'm angry. I'm really angry about this bill. And I'm going to tell you why. We just passed a bill that went into effect January 1st of this year, in which we set reasonable limits around prior authorization for chronic conditions. These are kids with rare diseases. These are kids like the 10-year-old that have been tried and failed 10 medications before they found something that worked. And these are the same people who told me time and time again that they spent months collecting documentation so that their child would not have the risk that they wouldn't get their medication on time when it needed to be reauthorized the next year. Because they knew that that reauthorization meant the difference between life and death. 95% of chronic conditions they sail through prior authorization with no issues, no concerns, the first time. And yet we're gonna ask a diabetic to keep coming back year after year after year on some sort of a fishing expedition? We're going to take time away from physicians who are actually doing patient care to spend time on things that are going to be approved at 95 to 98% of the time? Now, prior authorization has a role to play. It certainly does. And there are places where we could save money. But if we're not spending our time on prior authorization for kids with chronic conditions, for example, who have life-threatening conditions, whether it's or adults who have cardiac issues or high blood pressure or whatever it is, we could be spending that instead on looking at the actual places where prior authorization could, in fact, make a difference, where it could actually be fraudulent, where it could actually be a cost initiative that really needs examination. But instead, what we're trying to do in this bill, effectively, is take an end run around the very bill we just passed into law that just became the law of the land January 1st. The very one, by the way, if you go talk to your constituents at the door, they will herald you for getting it passed. Every single person I have ever talked to about this bill has literally cheered, given me high fives for this bill. And now we're suggesting that we're going to reverse course and that we're not going to take care of patients? That's baloney. And I want to say, for the folks of the health plans who are working on this, you know, they asked me about a few different things. And I said that I was willing to work with them on some of their issues. But this bill is not about dealing with that issue. What it's doing is undoing much of the things that we did that actually serve patients. And so I'm sorry, but I am going to be pretty pissed off about this bill. And I have a right to be. And I have a right to be on behalf of 5.6 million Minnesotans. So let's get it right, people. And if the health plans want to talk about some issue of a one-off case, then they are more than free to come talk to me.
Representative Nadeau.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And I appreciate your passion. I'm upset, too. We lost a health care. We lost a premium. We lost an insurance company in Minnesota. We lost an insurance carrier in Minnesota. And this bill isn't about ratcheting anything back. This bill is about moving forward with what we started with. This bill, prior authorization, is not about delivering care. Prior authorization under current law, a plan, a payer, has 24 hours to respond. 24 hours. And they do it. And I get it that 98% are there. But there is also, there's thing our partners need to work together. And the animosity that you have for these payers that lost $571 million on this population, because we, in this legislature, in this committee, fail to pay for the cost of care, I think is misplaced. There's no plans trying to do anything and trying to inhibit care from people. Their job is to manage a risk, just like providers' job is to care for their patients. And the more that we fight about these things and the more challenges that are there, the more difficult it is. So this bill doesn't do a lot of what you talked about. It does specifically what I stated in my introduction. And it basically is trying to find that balance so that healthcare providers can work more in alignment with the payers. That's what they are. They're paying to work in alignment to ensure that we don't have waste, that we don't have fraud, and that we don't have abuse.
Okay. We have two more reps here. And then Representative Bonner, briefly, please. We have two more, and then we need to get to a next bill, please.
Briefly, we should not punish 98% of the patients for the 2%. Not only that, if there are ways in which we can make the improve the process, I have said I am more than willing to have that conversation. But this is not an appropriate way to do that, and we did not lose a healthcare organization because of prior authorization. There are many factors that went into that loss, which we could go into and elaborate for hours. We will not do that here today. But just to be clear, we did not lose the healthcare organization because of prior authorization for chronic conditions.
Representative Carroll, and then we'll do Representative Ryer, and then we'll move on. Representative Carroll, we had that you wanted to, had a question?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I will in a different bill.
Okay. We'll put you on deck. Thank you. Right. Okay. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ryer, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair.
Vice Chair, I should say.
My recollection when we did this work some time ago and we passed Representative Bonner's bill was that the concern that was raised over and over had nothing to do with fraud, waste, and abuse. Those words didn't come out at all as far as I could tell, and it was a drumbeat of, oh no, patient safety, patient safety, patient safety. I looked back just now at the notes, the handouts people had sent us in the previous session. 50 pages, AHIP, PCMA, Cigna, Health Plan Partnership all cited their concerns about patient safety if we back down on prior authorization. I would like to also point out that hasn't come up at all today. And Vice Chair Nadeau, I would just like your comment on why the change in why prior auth is important. To me, it's absolutely counterintuitive that something that is in the moment affecting patients should be one of our fraud, waste, and abuse tools. It seems very unusual and misplaced, in my opinion, but I would love to hear from you. Thank you.
Representative Dole.
Yeah, thank you. And so if you look at the bill, the data sharing component, like right now, if a plan, for example, suspects fraud, let's use the housing stabilization services. There was a number of reports that were made from managed care organizations that were forced to utilize the DHS list. They made those recommendations to the department, and the department didn't do anything, nor did they notify the other partners. So that would be one. Retrospective reviews, utilization, post-utilization. I happen to believe that post-utilization is probably better than prior authorization. You know, because let's get rid of the prior authorization and go to post-utilization and ensure that patients can't be charged for non-medically necessary care. I have a feeling that our friends that are providers wouldn't like that system either. So again, this bill is, I don't remember the conversations being about patient safety as much as I remember it being that there needs to be this balance where if there's step therapies that should be in place that could be more cost effective, and as we all know in this room, healthcare system moves at the speed of light. I mean, if there's ways that we can make our system more efficient, we should. We absolutely should. And, you know, our current laws are pretty strict that a plan has 24 hours. If they deny, they have 24 hours. And you probably remember, we put this into the bill a couple of years ago about what is our fee-for-service denial rate. We haven't seen those numbers yet. And I'm not saying this to make this comparison because I don't want anybody to be denied. But at the same time, we need to have a functional system where the partners are working in unison. And if you're a provider and you want to do particular treatments and the patient has insurance, there should be a member partnership there that works to ensure that we're getting there.
Any follow-up? Okay. I said two. Representative Bierman's going to take Representative Carroll's mistaken spot. Okay. So Representative Bierman said had a short question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. I just had a question regarding some of the verbiage on a few different places in the bill. I'll just summarize. One, it says standard of treatment. Another one, it says current standard of treatment time frame. Another one just says standard of care. So my question is, who is defining these terms for conditions, please?
Representative Dole.
I believe it's the standard of care, and again, I'm not a physician, so maybe we want to have a physician come back, but it's my understanding is that at the level where we're looking at treatment mechanisms, it is the standard of care is established by the provider. And then if there is something outside of that standard, then prior authorization would basically ask that question, request additional information from the provider within 24 hours, and then that provider would be, and then between those two entities, then the provider would move forward.
Mr. Follow-up? Chair, I'd really like to ask the doctor, but I know on the basis of time, I'm going to do that offline.
Okay, because this bill will be laid over.
Yes, exactly. And so my concern is whether those terms are coming from the medical community or from plans. And I'm having a recent experience where plans are changing chart of benefits on customers who have been expecting them and handling them for years. And so I'm very leery of any terms like this that are not clearly defined. I'll take it offline, though, and talk to the medical community about this, since it's just going, just being laid over.
Sure.
Thank you. Representative Doe, final words?
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. Hearing no further discussion, House File 4801 will be laid over. And thank you, member. We have House File 3756. And, yes, I would like to move this bill to get in front of the committee.
Okay, House File 3756 will be laid over. We have the bill before us. Representative Backer, tell us about your bill.
House File 3756 is a really straightforward technical update to Minnesota's Insulin Safety Network program. This bill makes minor clarifications by defining covered insulin, specifically that the program provides access to covered insulin and making a series of technical updates to improve clarity and consistency in the statute. And I will turn it over to my testifier there, Chair Nadeau.
All right. State your name and start your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I work at Winthrop & Weinstein, but today I'm representing Baxter Healthcare. And the Insulin Safety Net program was established in 2020 and consists of an urgent need program and continuing safety net program for individuals that are in need of insulin to manage diabetes. In contrast, my client manufactures a product called Mixredlin, a ready-to-use intravenous insulin infusion used to control high blood sugar in hospitalized patients. It is commonly used in acute care settings with patients who have recently undergone major surgery or are suffering from a critical illness. Unlike insulin products in the urgent need program, the product is never sold directly to a patient. It is never used by a patient on themselves. It is never bought by a patient at a retail pharmacy. And unlike insulin products in the urgent need program, this product is always sold directly to a healthcare institution, always infused by a healthcare practitioner into a patient, and always sold and paid for through a pre-negotiated contract with a hospital. This legislation simply clarifies that products like Mixredlin are not part of the Insulin Safety Net program, as was intended when the legislation first passed. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3756? All right. Is there further discussion on the bill? Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Backer. Just a clarification question. As practices change with different treatments, is there a possibility that putting this outside of scope for this would limit a legitimate but new use for the this particular form of insulin? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ryer, I'd be happy to have Aaron Patterson from the Board of Pharmacy come up and clarify if he would like to. But my understanding is that, you know, this legislation was drafted in close consultation with the Board of Pharmacy, the revisor's office, to ensure that that wouldn't happen. And the definition that was put in place was tried to be very, very specific to ensure that that would not be the case.
Please state your name.
Aaron Patterson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. Vice Chair and Committee. No, I believe that if the treatments were to change, the labeling for this product would also need to change in order for that to be able to be eligible for patients to use it outside of a controlled setting. So completely the labeling would have to change, and based on the language within the bill, if the labeling was changed and it was not just for institutional use only, it should not be able to be outside of the program scope then. Yeah, good question. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, hearing no further discussion, House File 3756 will be laid over. All right. The fourth bill we have for consideration today is House File 4860. Representative Backer, would you like to move House File 4860, get it in front of the committee?
I would do. Thank you, Chair.
And members, House File 4860 will be laid over. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Backer, tell us about your bill.
Yeah, House File 4860 is really a practical patient-centered proposal to expand access to prescription medicine. Other states are doing this. Communities, like several of the communities that I serve in the district I serve, are pharmacy deserts. So this allows licensed pharmacies to operate secure remote sites such as a local grocery store. And one of the reasons I like the local grocery stores, and as Representative Hewitt would know, is that you get to see the patient. There would be some training. I've worked with the Board of Pharmacy on this. So if someone comes in, you get to see them instead of getting their prescription over in the mail order, because when they get in the mail order, you don't get to see the paleness. And, you know, in a small community, you just know when someone's not healthy. So this is very important in rural and undeserved areas where patients often face long distance and limited pharmacy hours, like in my community, zero pharmacy hours. This bill helps meet patients where they are, making it easier to pick up needed medicines close to home. For example, we already have a hospital that comes into our community and delivers pharmaceutical drugs to the nursing home. So this would just fit into that. Importantly, House File 4860 maintains strong safeguards. Medications remain under the control of the licensed pharmacy, securely stored, and are only released after identification, proper identification, and once a pharmacist is counseled. And of course, there's always that continued counseling. This is a smart, safe way that has been working with other states. And again, we know that health matters to our Minnesota citizens, and this is another way to make sure they're getting their proper medication. And with that, Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Today we're going to hear from two testifiers on House File 4860. Please limit your testimony to 90 seconds to ensure everyone gets the opportunity to speak. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Vice Chair and members of the committee. Stacy Barstead, Administrator and Chief Executive Officer of Sanford Westbrook Medical Center in Westbrook, Minnesota. Westbrook is a rural community of roughly 750 residents, and we have one of the smallest hospitals in Minnesota operating as an 8-bed critical access hospital with an emergency room and clinic. At the beginning of the year, Westbrook suddenly lost its only retail pharmacy downtown. Since that closure, our residents, including one quarter who are 65 and older, must now travel 20, 30, or more miles to fill their prescriptions. When patients must already travel out of town for medications, they are more likely to seek health care elsewhere. Over time, this can gradually shift away from the local medical center. House File 4860 would allow a pharmacy depot model in communities that can no longer support a traditional pharmacy. A pharmacy depot is not a full retail pharmacy, but it allows patients to safely pick up prescriptions locally through coordination with a licensed pharmacy. In Westbrook, one practical way this could work is through a partnership with our local grocery store. A trusted, centrally located place residents visit regularly. A pharmacy depot located there would allow patients, especially seniors, to access medications locally without needing to leave town. Any pharmacy depot would operate under the oversight of a licensed pharmacy, and medications would be in secure, controlled areas with limited access. In rural communities like Westbrook, a pharmacy is not a convenience. It is a critical part of the local healthcare ecosystem. House File 4860 gives communities like ours a practical, safe option to preserve access and keep local healthcare systems viable. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up is Gary Carlson, and he is virtual.
Hi, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm the president of Maynard's Food Centers, currently operating 15 stores, small town stores in South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa, 8 of which are in Southwest Minnesota. One is in Westbrook. We feel that it is especially important for access to the patients in that small town not having to leave town for their own safety, as well as it might strengthen the hospital and our own grocery store. Maynard's, we currently operate a pharmacy depot in our store in Lake Preston, South Dakota, and we've been doing that since 2018. We take delivery from the pharmacy in a nearby town multiple days of the week. We have a secured cabinet in which they're located. The pickup of the prescriptions can only be given to the patient by a trained employee in that store. We feel that the grocery stores are a natural fit because we generally have increased hours. We are a trusted institution within the town, and it would help this bill, 4860, would help strengthen the hospital, pharmacies, local providers in town, as well as the grocery store. Thank you very much, committee and Chair Backman, for this opportunity to testify in this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Is there any other one in the audience that would like to testify on House File 4860? All right. Hearing no further discussion, Representative Hewitt.
Oh, you're in a, go ahead.
Sorry. You were second. Representative Carroll's first.
Well, since you called on Representative.
Hey, this is the chair's prerogative. I want to hear from Representative Carroll first.
Well, and I
that just puts me where I'm at here.
Exactly. Excellent.
Let's see a fight. It looks like a fight is brewing.
Not a
right
fight
now.
At all. It's nothing but love.
Okay.
So I have a question. How would this bill potentially affect Minnesota pharmacies? It seems like it would permit just about any pharmacy anywhere to set up as many sites as they wish. Could an out-of-state pharmacy, for example, do that as well? And then I also wonder about, are there pharmacy deserts or grocery store deserts, I guess I should say. But answer my first question. Then
yeah,
I have a follow-up.
Chair Nadeau, Representative Carroll, my focus, and that's something, my focus is a local pharmacy. I'm not looking to have, you bring a very good question, not looking to have an Amazon send stuff in or anything like that. My goal is to have local pharmacy, and I think we're going to have to tighten up the language a little bit to make sure that happens, because that is, in the last couple of days, that's something that's been brought up. They've not seen that in South Dakota. And where we initially got the idea from, got the idea when I visit with Mr. Carlson there. So we're going to have to work on that a little bit. That's why it's being laid over in regards, because you bring a good point. I do not want that to happen. My goal is, for example, in Browns Valley, we already have the essential, the pharmacy in Graceville, which is Sanford, comes to the nursing home in our community. We would just work out them. So, good point. Thank you.
Follow up?
Yes, sir.
So, I realize one of the problems is lack of pharmacies in some areas. Does this bill limit the solution to those areas as opposed to maybe the metro or more urbanized areas?
Representative Backer.
I'm sorry, Chair Nadeau. My apologies. Right now, as the bill is written, it doesn't have any limitation on it. It's something that we have to work with, because there are areas that have wide pharmacy deserts. Like, I'm 20 miles away, the closest one in Minnesota, which would be Graceville. So right now there is not that limitation to that, something that we're going to be working on.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Carroll. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair Nadeau. I would like to have the, as long as he's in the room, the pharmacy person come back up. Representative Backer, thank you for this bill. Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, thank you for this bill. We definitely have deserts in greater Minnesota, and is this one of the ways we can go about that? But I'm curious, because one of my jobs in former life when I was in college was being a pharmacy tech, and it was really interesting, and I don't know if things have changed since the 80s. I'm dating myself here, but to the director of pharmacy, isn't it true you have to have a pharmacist in-house when you dispense? I mean, pharmacies get shut down when pharmacists go on break. Is that changed, or what's new to the law that would make this actually viable?
Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name again.
Dr. Aaron Patterson, Executive Director of Minnesota Board of Pharmacy.
Thank you.
Proceed. Chair and committee members. No, nothing's changed. In fact, there are additional prohibitions in statute that would require a pharmacist to be present and personally supervise those types of transactions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
Yes, and so that's interesting because I'm even hearing about machines that dispense medications like in a hospital lobby or whatever, and I'm kind of confused at how that happens today and how medications can be delivered by mail, but yet in a common day pharmacy, the pharmacist has to be in-house. Is there any, I'm confused. Thank you.
Sure. Representative Backer, or testifier, sorry.
Yeah, Chair and committee member. The machines that you speak of, I think, are probably something like an InstiMed machine or something like that, which is typically a physician dispensing system. Technically, the physicians who are on site and operating that particular clinic and are present on site are the ones who are running that system, and there's interaction with a pharmacist online through a video system / telephone system for the operation of that machine.
One last question.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Backer. Maybe you can help on this question, too. You said training. Is this training to the farm tech level? What kind of training are you looking at? And I, again, I'm intrigued with this idea, but I'd like to know that if someone's asking a question about a prescription, how do we make sure that they're getting the knowledge? It's a humongous world, though. I mean, they've got a big red book on this thing. And so how do you make sure that they're getting the best information to the patient? And is there a pharmacist on call? And again, back to the pharmacy director, is the training? I'm concerned about the training.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, I'm going to start and I'll pass it over to testifier. First of all, the first time they get their medicines, they have to visit with the pharmacist. So these are the ongoing, and if there's any changes to dosage, they would have to go back to the pharmacist, okay, and so forth. And also, the bill does not do any narcotics or anything like that. So these are, you know, the laces, those type of medicines. So, and then, of course, the training would be very focused on making sure the proper person getting the pharmacist. And then there will be some other, what I'm hoping for is that there will be also some other training in which if somebody looks sick or something like that there too. So, but I'm going to turn it over to Stacy.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Stacy Barstead from Westbrook. Yes, the training, you know, I think when you're training the grocery store workers that are there, it's going to be focusing a lot on the HIPAA regulations, you know, what can be shared, the security of those drugs, to be able to make sure that they're logged out appropriately and everything on that level for the grocery store. There wouldn't be any pharmacy techs that would be working there, but it would be down to the grocery store, you know, workers that would have to ensure that they're following and being in compliance when they are giving those meds to patients that come in. And then, you know, just making sure that they're locked up and that kind of stuff. And then also if they're needing to, wanting to talk with a pharmacist, just having that information there, who to call, what to do, and if a patient looks sick, you know, if they do come up, what to do in that type of case. So more of a procedural type there with the grocery store workers.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like the pharmacist.
Very
director.
Quickly, please. Mr. Chair and committee members, yes, there's a minimum requirement for technicians to be registered in the state of Minnesota. This bill doesn't have that as a part of the components of the bill. Generally, a technician could register with the state of Minnesota and be registered for the first year of their employment until they renewed, and then by the following year they would need to have received certain training in order to continue to be registered. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, more confused, but that's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Mahmoud.
Thank you, Chair. I would say thank you for this bill. It's important that we increase access. That should definitely be one of our top priorities. But considering what evidence from other states, I know you mentioned South Dakota, would show that remote pickup sites do not increase diversion of high-risk medications?
Representative Backer.
Yes, good question. I don't have a good answer for you. I mean, I really have focused in on, we grabbed the South Dakota model, and we worked off that because they've been doing it successfully. So I don't have a good answer for you. It's something I'll have to do some research. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, then.
Okay.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, and maybe,
check in with the Board of Pharmacy? I'd love to hear, what are your thoughts, any risks? Appreciate to hear about your concerns, if any.
Sure, Chair and committee members. There is a concern, and there's a little bit of a misconception about the South Dakota model. The South Dakota model, they just worked on some statutes to change their regulations and then impose rules that govern this process this year. And so what we're operating under for this bill doesn't necessarily take those types of factors into consideration for this particular language. As far as the risk for diversion and whatnot of interest meds, I think, yes, there's a risk for that. There is no real way where controlled substances could be moved from one site at a pharmacy to a remote site like this because they don't possess the required DEA registration to do so. And, you know, among the other things that are required for supervision in the pharmacy and whatnot, they just wouldn't be able to do those types of things. I think the larger concern would be with concerns for privacy risk and things like that in a small community.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Follow up? You
no,
good?
Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you for this bill. I will just say I think I've long been a proponent of meeting people where they are, and so I like that concept of this. And I know you said this would be primarily used for more like maintenance medications, which is really helpful context as well. I'm not sure if that's clearly spelled out in the bill, but worth noting that that might be a good way to address some of the concerns that Representative Mahmoud brought up. And I think those are really valid concerns and ones that I share. So making that a little bit more clear. I won't go too far into this because this is not my bill, but I know that the chair had a bill about putting some sites into local hospitals who maybe don't have their own pharmacy. And certainly I'm not opposed to the grocery stores, but I'm curious, do we know what happened to that bill? Do we know, is that still under consideration? And that might be have a little bit different set of criteria than maintenance meds, but just curious where that stands.
Representative Backer.
It's there for discussion. You know, you and I are very much similar on this, Representative Bonner. We want to go to where people need the meds and so forth. So I'm bringing this forward to the discussion because it has worked, yes, in a different mindset setting. But you are correct. There are places, there are communities that don't have grocery stores, and that's why we want to have this discussion, because at the end of the day, we want to go where the people are. So that's not out of consideration right now.
Go ahead, Representative Bonner.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. And I would love to see more conversation about that going forward, both on the, you know, in the grocery stores, making sure that those are around maintenance meds, and then if we were to do this in hospitals, how we might make that model work as well. My other question is about, you know, I didn't see in the packet anywhere, but do we have folks that have weighed in from the Grocers Association, and if they're willing to take on that extra responsibility? Have we talked to the pharmacists, and particularly the Mint Indies? One of my biggest concerns would be, A, are the grocery stores willing to take on that risk? And B, also for those independent pharmacies, and you know, and I know you said it was your intent that we could allow local independent pharmacies to partner in these sites. And I guess, you know, it's no secret that I have been a huge proponent of
making sure that those resources stay in our communities, especially in greater Minnesota, where there's a real access problem. These are folks who can answer on-the-spot questions that can be a real part of that. But I'd like to ensure their survivability. And I do want to make sure that in this bill that there is a real preference to push to those local independent pharmacies, folks who have boots on the ground, pharmacists behind the counter, that can sort of provide backup for these locations. And that's where I would really like to see us focus. And I don't know if you've thought more about that. I know you mentioned that was your intent, but maybe you could speak more to the grocers and where those the Minnesota Indies and the pharmacists fall on this issue.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, Chair, I have talked to the Grocery Association here in Minnesota, and they're in support of it. I've not talked to the Independent Pharmacists Association. I've talked to independent pharmacists, and they like the idea.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is an interesting bill and interesting to think about this concept, but I do have a couple questions about it. One is, Mr. Chair Backer, you haven't addressed, I don't think, whether there are any additional costs, either for patients or for, does the grocery store that hosts one of these, do they make money for doing it or do they pay money to do it? I don't know which, you know, or is it just a neutral thing as a service to customers? Maybe it increases customer traffic in the store. But I'd kind of like to understand that. If there are money flowing over this, how is it working? And then my second, just for the sake of time, I'll just ask my second question, which is, can mail order pharmacies also use this? So right now, you know, mail order pharmacy, there's, you know, big push to use them. I guess they save money. All the PBMs want you to use their mail order pharmacy. And so that kind of cuts out the small, the small pharmacies. You know, it's kind of devastated them, in fact. And now, if mail order pharmacies can use this, now we're giving the mail order pharmacy the additional advantage of having a place, a footprint. Mm-hmm. So I have some, you know, are they included in this? Can they use it as well? Or is it your intention that they be included? Could they be cut out of it?
Yeah.
Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, it's first question, it's a service. A lot of people know, especially in small towns, your grocery stores are there, yes, to make a profit, but their margins are tight. And it's really a service. It is to help, because generally in your smaller communities, your customer base tends to be older because they don't want to travel. So it is my intent in talking to the Grocers Association and others, grocers, it's not there to be a money-making, it's providing service. Yes, that means there's going to be more foot traffic. Okay, so there is that benefit there. That's outweigh it. Second of all, I'm not interested. My intent on this was not to include the mail order. My intent is to help, as we know, your independent pharmacists, if they're consulting them initially, and if there's something that they need to consult it, you're not able to consult with a mail order pharmacist as easy as even if once every 6 months you have to drive from Browns Valley to Graceville or Westbrook to wherever the community is where the pharmacist is. So that's my intent. Keep it focused locally, no mail order.
So, Mr. Chair, just for clarification, if I may.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Thank you. On the so, Chair Backer, on the cost issue, so you're saying that the grocery store charges a small fee to the person picking it up, or
No. It's a service, meaning no fee. There is no intention to charge any fees.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Thank you, Representative Backer. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I appreciate this bill. My spouse is a pharmacist, and I think your daughter is a pharmacist, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's
right?
Correct.
And I have a town in my district that a grocery store that is probably a half hour, 20 minutes away, 25 minutes away from any pharmacy. And so this will be a real plus. And so I'm really glad to see you working on this, and I appreciate this. My question is to the board. this has worked pretty well in South Dakota. This, and maybe this is to you too, Chair. Well, it's worked pretty well in South Dakota. What you said there was some minor tweaks or issues. I'm just curious what that was.
Sure, go Chair ahead. And Representative Van Binsbergen. There are some additional workings in statute that would need to be adjusted in order for this to be a viable solution, in order for there not to be gray area for the folks who would be participating, because it would otherwise be prohibited in other statutes based on other portions of what was happening here. Partly the transfer and delivery of prescriptions in a space that wasn't certified or wasn't registered or licensed as a pharmacy, and where there were no licensed individuals at all. Each one of those two items is a kind of a big hurdle for this bill to overcome, and it needs to be considered for that.
Thank you. To answer that, and we have been working, the board's been really good to work with on this, and we're working through those bumps.
Follow up? Last comment. I just really want to encourage the board to get, I hope you get involved and move forward on this. I think this is real important, especially to rural Minnesota and our small communities that, we've got a lot of elderly people. They're on the roads in the middle of the winter, and this just it allows them to stay at home. So I just, I hope you jump on board and get behind this. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Chair Nadeau. Thank you, Chair Bacow, for bringing the bill forward. And, we had some conversations with the pharmacy board and a pilot idea. And I had the pleasure of meeting also with the executive director, Ms. Barstead. We talked about the hospital there, the smallest hospital in Minnesota, right? And, the need for a drop-off and access like this. So I, too, am behind the concept. And I really think that there's, a ways to work this out. But I would encourage some of the talk and questions that members had to look closely at how it would affect independent pharmacies, and also just the expansion of just not grocery stores only, because that's very limiting, and there are other facilities around the state that don't maybe have a grocery store, but they maybe have a clinic or someplace else where this could work out quite well. So appreciate the work we did together on it before, and think that the concept is good, and there's a place for it in Minnesota, just maybe limited to the areas of need. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Backer, closing remarks.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. House File 4860 will be laid over. Fifth bill we have for consideration today is House File 4931. Representative Backer, would you please move House File 4931? Get it before the committee.
So moved.
House File 4931 will be laid over. We have the bill before us. Representative Backer, tell us about your bill.
Yes, with the single administrative language that was passed, there was an understanding that it would lead to system-wide savings with the potential to reinvest those savings into higher reimbursement rates for providers. Over the past year, as the Dental Administrator Work Group has met, it has been difficult to clearly identify those savings. At the same time, we've seen proposals come forward aimed at increasing reimbursements in a budget-neutral way, while the department has indicated there may, in fact, be a cost. Members, what we're seeing is, across the country, a range of approaches in the dental space on how to diversify the payer models. Here in Minnesota, we're taking a different path, and it's important that we fully understand what's going to happen. So given the complexity of this issue, I believe it would be beneficial to take an additional time to work with stakeholders, look at the challenges, ensure that we are moving forward in the best possible way for the patients, because as we serve on this committee, because we know that we want to provide the best health care, including dental. With that, I'll turn it over to my testifier and appreciate your support.
Thank you, members. We have one testifier today. Please limit your comments to 90 seconds. State your name and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is John Canelis. I work for the Caring Hands Dental Clinic, critical access safety net dental provider, two locations, one in Alexandria, Minnesota, and one in Pipestone. We've averaged 15,000 appointments over the last 2 years with 94% of our patients on a Minnesota healthcare program. I'm here today to support House File 4931, delaying single administrator payments for 2 more years. I have 3 items for this committee to consider: funding, access, and process. From a funding perspective, moving to a single administrator cuts reimbursements for all critical access dental providers without any additional action by the legislature. We're being asked to take lower reimbursements for providing the same services. Those who serve the highest percentage of MA patients in their clinics will be taking the biggest cut. This will impact care capacity overall or access. The second point is access. To give each of you an idea of what the state access really looks like, I provided a heat map so you can see.
30-second warning.
The zip code. What?
30 seconds.
Oh, so the zip codes that are represented by the patients that our clinic has served. If you want to improve access, we really need to improve rates. And then from a process perspective, there really hasn't been anything demonstrating evidence supporting a $400 million decision impacting 1.2 million people. In closing, House File 4931 is simply seeking to pause for another 2 years and not asking these clinics to take a pay cut. If you truly want to address access, address the rates, then worry about who's paying them. Please give us 2 more years to evaluate single administrator in this critical access dental space. I submit these remarks with great respect and appreciate each of your service to the public.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak on this bill? All right, seeing none, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, surprise, surprise, surprise. Somebody wants to push this back by another 2 years. How many years should we wait before Minnesota patients who supposedly have coverage for dental actually get dental care? You know, that is the problem. I have open on my laptop here the dashboard that the Minnesota Department of Human Services keeps, and the data is only as recent as 2023. But we are, and not just on fee-for-service, but the managed care organizations are absolutely failing at getting care to patients. And we all know that dental care is important for your general health. You can't be healthy and have a mouthful of rotten teeth. And the kids on medical assistance are not getting care. So, I mean, I frankly find this really disturbing. I mean, we can just keep kicking the can down the road. Chair Backer, I'd like to know, did you get this bill from the managed care organizations? Are they helping you with this here, or is this just coming from your own idea?
Representative Backer.
Yeah, I have worked with Caring Hands on this. So, no, I'm not working with any managed care. The challenge that we're having, and I've had the opportunity to not just visit their facility, but also Apple Tree and Fergus Falls, these people do a phenomenal job with what they have. They just don't have the resources in this, you know. I do not disagree with you. It's not wise to kick things down the road. That's not the intent here, Representative Leaving. The intent is, when I sat down with these two organizations, no managed care whatsoever, sat down with them, it's not working for them. And here's the greatest concern I have. This summer, I had someone who called out of the blue, not even one of my constituents, down in Yellow Medicine County, knew it was a week associate, and she was like, Jeff, can you help me out? We have this situation with my, was it daughter or son? I don't remember whether, because they went to the Pipestone, And I started to call around to try to help this person. And I think it was a daughter and so forth. And so it got to my attention more, because whenever we have a personal dealing with somebody, you start to dig into it. And I started to dig into this further, and I have quite a concern that these facilities won't have the money with the system, and we're going to see less and less and less and less. That's my concern. That's why I got involved with this, no managed care, just concerned with dental care.
Follow up, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I don't know if you're aware, Chair Backer, that, you know, one of our MCOs, we've got Health Partners, you know, is vertically integrated. So they're both a delivery system and an insurer. And I assume it's still true that they pay their own dentists who are critical access dentists. They actually have a special deal in state statute, and they get paid more than other dentists that are getting where the patient is on their insurance but isn't getting from one of their providers. So, you know, this system is really screwed up, and it makes no sense for the state to be spending money with using 5 or 7 or 8 different systems and wasting money managing, having all these different people manage what is really all the same program. And, you know, so the idea and part of the concept of carving this out for managed care was always that it would free up other money that could then be actually put into the dental program. And even beyond that, it would give us legislators, the state, and the Department of Human Services the actual policy levers to figure out where do we need another dentist? What can we do to actually fix this or that? Because the managed care organizations were given the opportunity, and there were these plans where they were supposed to come in, and if they didn't hit a certain number of people getting their visits, they were supposed to come in with a plan to rectify it and work with the department, and that all happened and happened and happened, and basically no progress has been made if you look at the dashboard. And so you can kick the can down the road if you want, but I think it's absolutely absurd to keep doing the same thing over and over and over and over again and saying, oh, we'll figure it out in another 2 years. Well, we're not going to figure it out until the pressure is on and the thing's going to happen, and then we're going to say, okay, now we're going to make this thing work. Otherwise, change will never come. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Backer?
Yeah, just a quick comment. The challenge that we have had, and Chair Nadeau said that earlier, over the years we've had more people into MA without extra dollars. And to assume government will do a better job is a poor assumption. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Backman, for bringing this bill for consideration today. Overall, a question for the testifier, really just to understand this two-year piece, what would those additional 2 years do for the organization in my district?
Mr. Chair. When you look at the additional 2 years and what's being asked for here right now, there's 30 total organizations providing 90% of the actual appointments that are taking place here. Like, there's only 30 organizations responsible for 90% of the appointments in the state. All you have to do is talk to the 30 people and ask them, how are they best positioned? Most of them will look at you and say, it's about the rates. We don't care who pays us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Representative Schumacher, follow up. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And pretty much, thank you, Representative Schumacher. That was going to be my question. I will put on the record that I think the Dental Administration Working Group has the best acronyms out there, DOG. I love it. I would love to see more in regards to, has there been a report? Again, in the legislature, getting information from these working groups, from the time that it takes. I also am concerned that things have not been rectified and that a two-year delay, what is the process in that and what is happening with that? So you did answer some of those questions on just, you know, visiting with those 30 providers would be very helpful. I think that could be done pretty quickly. So, you know, just wondered if there's any way that I could get more information from the working group to see what has been done. And that's, I just want to put that on the record.
Representative Backer.
Go ahead.
I would look to the people and probably turn that back to the DOG group and any representatives supporting it to get that over. But I would be more than happy to share, certainly.
Thanks.
Same here.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Oh, sorry. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all. I'm going to try and make eye contact with you, Chair Backer, but there's a lot of people.
We have people.
Yeah, thank you.
Peek behind the screen, too.
No, go ahead.
I have a number of questions. In 2025, when we passed the bill, we had extensive conversations. We had all the stakeholders involved, Minnesota Dental Association, the Critical Access Dental, various groups as they existed at that point, as well as individual clinics, Delta Dental, the managed care organizations, county business. CVP, the folks. This all resulted in decisions like carving out county-based purchasing, which had been a specific concern, especially up in Chair Backer, in your part of the state. And we ended up with a
I'm just I'm listening to you, Vice
Chair. We ended up with a bipartisan bill co-authored by both you and Vice Chair Nadeau and Chair Bierman, of course. We laid out a plan, a two-year plan, because my concern with the original timeline was that there wasn't a work plan and that we weren't going to have a mechanism for setting rates that would capture the funding from the managed care differential so that care providers wouldn't go back to the fee-for-service rate. We had the dental access work group met, and I think it's quite an adorable DAWG dog acronym, but they worked really hard. They spent a lot of time on data. They went through, they came up with four different recommendations, two that were not budget neutral, because of the hope that the state and the agency and the legislature would see that we are asking a dental system that focuses on the neediest of dental patients, that we would stop asking them to get by on a wing and a prayer, and that we would invest in it. So a couple of non-budget neutral items. However, what I had promised in carrying the previous legislation was that we would have a budget neutral bill that we would then build on. Representative Gilman, I'll follow up with DHS. I don't have something I can release, but I'll follow up with them on your behalf. We laid out this plan. We've been working this plan. The emphasis of the plan was to focus on the rates in time for this session so that we could get them in place so that Delta Dental, who had been chosen as the administrator, would be able to have enough time to put the system in place and test it and do any development that was needed. Because how many times have organizations, including the state of Minnesota, seen tech projects fail because we don't leave time for proper implementation requirements, generation, and testing. So we put all that in place. We're working that plan. It's going fine. People are on time, and we have information to move forward. Chair Backer, my first question for you is, what took you from being a co-author and a partner in this plan to now saying, well, we need two more years?
Yeah.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, sure. Real easy. When I visit Caring Hands in Appletree, they shared with me their dire concern of that the savings that we thought that we would get when we talked last year, which we had quite a few passionate talks, and I know this is important to you, it's just not there. As we heard from Caring Hands here, they don't care how they get paid. They just want better reimbursements. So when I had the opportunity to do it, and I mean, I've been visiting, even though Caring Hands is not in the district I represent, it's actually Representative Franson, but I do have constituents that go to Alexandra and so forth. It was like, the savings aren't there. We have 30 of these facilities. we don't want any more of these facilities closed. So that's what said, hey, we need to put a pause. And I get the challenge of kicking the can down the road. This was not something easy for me to do because, as you said, we were negotiating it. But what's even harder is seeing clinics serve. And when you get the call from a non-constituent in Yellow Medicine County saying, what do I do with this emergency? And the closest one we could find them was Pipestone and Alexandria. It's quite the distance. It's a two-hour trip.
Follow-up, Representative Ryer.
Yes, thank you. So if we delay another 2 years, you know, the other things that are going to go away that we have worked into this current bill, that not this one, but the new rebasing, we'll delay that rebasing. We'll still be living with 1989 actuals, which clearly does not reflect how the dental industry practices anymore. And that's an important issue that we've been facing all this time. We also will not have the inflationary increase to keep rates from continuing to lose momentum against the cost of living. So those things will also not happen. And so I think that I'm wondering if you've considered the downside, Chair Backer, of a delay, an additional 2 years.
Representative Backer.
Yes.
Thank
and
you.
The
Follow
my
up?
Concern is the closing of those 30 clinics.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. As we know, we have to make difficult decisions. So, yes, I have considered that.
All right.
Do you? Thank you, Chair. Is there a fiscal note on this?
No.
Will one be requested?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
This will
and
be laid over also.
Also,
Representative Ryer.
I would just like to know who you've met with to discuss the implications. I get that you've talked about the concerns. I understand that. But the implications, for example, when we were talking about this last year, we talked about a two-year delay because a contract had been RFP'd and Delta Dental was selected back in 2024, I think, at end of 2024. And we talked about how to handle that with a two-year delay. Because back when I was doing contracts for various things in my business life, you know, my prices and my structure and the business world didn't remain the same. Have you thought about the implication, had conversations with DHS and with others about the impact on the contractual relationships and what level of rework would be required if we have to start that over?
Representative Backer.
Yeah, my focus is to give the stakeholders more time. I have been focusing on the providers, have not talked to DHS.
My last comment.
Representative Ryer, this
comment.
Is the last one.
Last one.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to say that for the past 6 years, I've been working closely on dental reform, on making sure that the people who are least able to get care, and protecting with every breath the well-being of our critical access dental system, including working to make sure that the funds that come into this next iteration are going to them because you're the heart breath, the heart of this system. I just want to say that I want them to know that, and that I hope that this just gets laid over very quietly, and thinking that with no Senate author, that's probably likely. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Franson.
I'm good, thank you.
All right.
But I just, hold on, one sec. Thank you, John.
Thank you, John, for making the trip down here.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. You're always in the hot seat when you arrive. I don't know why.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Seeing no further discussion, any closing remarks, Representative Backer?
You know, I want to make sure whatever comes next works. So I understand your concerns, Representative Ryer. Same struggle that I have, and we'll be, as usual, we'll work together. Thank you.
Members, House File 4931 will be laid over.
The next bill we have for consideration is House File 4289. Representative Backer, would you like to move House File 4289 and get it before the committee?
Sure. Yes, please, Chair.
All right. House File 4289 is here. It will be laid over. Representative Backer, tell us about your bill.
Yeah, House File 4289 is really simple. In my opinion, a common sense bill that ensures every Minnesota child has access to one of the most basic documents they need, a certified birth certificate. This document isn't optional. It is required for school enrollment, identification, and access to critical services. For some families, even a modest fee can create a barrier or delay. This bill removes that barrier in a straightforward, effective way. One free copy per child, no bureaucracy. It's a small step with meaningful impact and a policy that reflects both fiscal restraints and fairness. And I ask your support for it. And as I said, birth certificates are essential for school enrollment, passport, driver's license, assessing some other type of benefits. And with that said, I know we have testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Members, today we have two testifiers on our agenda. All testimony is going to be limited to 90 seconds to ensure we have the opportunity to speak. Well, let's start with Barbara Olson. Please state your name and begin your testimony. When you're ready. Don't take too long, though.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Barbara Olson, and I'm here representing Hennepin County as your local registrar and as a representative of MACO. HF 4289 is currently written would create an unfunded financial mandate for all Minnesota counties. Using Hennepin County as an example, this bill is estimated to result in approximately $175,000 in lost revenue a year. At the same time, however, though, Hennepin County would still incur costs of about $172,000 per year to administer this service. This cost estimate includes labor, security paper to print the birth certificates on, as well as envelopes and postage. But the cost estimate does not account for additional administrative expenses such as IT support or facilities overhead. If HF 4289 moves forward without funding provisions, it would place a financial burden on Hennepin County taxpayers. We respectfully request that if the bill advances, it include financial support for Minnesota counties to cover the labor and resources required to provide this service. Thank you.
Thank you. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Mike Fangman, Rice County Recorder and member of MACO's Vital Record Advisory Committee. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, statistics published by the Minnesota Department of State, the Minnesota Department of Health, indicate that 1.1 million individuals have been born in the state of Minnesota in the last 17 years. As drafted, House File 4289 would allow or entitle those children to a free birth certificate. The bill does not exempt any of those that have already had a birth certificate issued to them. And that is assuming that the definition of the word child is for those 17 and under in this bill. In the vital record world, we use terms like child of subject, child of decedent, and those requesters are not necessarily 17 years or under. The cost associated with issuing birth records has increased, and the cost of birth records has increased over time.
30-second warning.
Yet the portion of the fee retained by the counties has only increased $1 in 29 years. Reducing our ability to generate revenue and cover some of the costs associated will increase local levies. Should House File 4289 move forward, we are requesting funding to be incorporated to offset the perpetual loss of revenue.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on House File 4289?
All right. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Yeah. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Becker, you know, this is, I think that this, the way we do it now has been in place for quite a long time. So the question I have for you is kind of, why now? What problem are you trying to solve that hasn't existed for a long time? I mean, it's great. I love to have people get free stuff. I mean, no question about it. I'm sure it would help a lot of folks, but why?
Representative Becker. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Representative Leaving. You know what? You know, last Wednesday, was it? Yeah. We heard a bill helping folks with being able to have little ones because of the challenges they have with pregnancy. I think it is very important that the state supports children. And quite frankly, it was when my daughter was born, because she was born in South Dakota, Kosciuszko, we did not have to pay for a birth certificate. And then when my granddaughter was born, it was like, oh, we have to pay for it? Why is not the state supporting life? In regards with once someone chooses to have one, we should make it as less barriers as possible. It is not a lot. I get it. It's just like with, you know, we heard with a testimony they're going to have to raise their levy. Well, if you look at Ramsey County, their budget is over $800 million, and this is less than 0.02% of their budget. So it came about just because I think the state should support little ones. That's why it came about. And parents, young parents, should not have to pay for one birth certificate and so forth. And the testifier made a good point. My intention is under 17, but that would need to be clarified. Made a very good point.
Any follow-up, Representative Liebling?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. No, I was just going to make that point about that the bill apparently isn't tailored to when a baby is born.
Yeah, you're right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that would probably cut the cost considerably, but you know, I also do think that we often talk here about unfunded mandates mm-hmm. and not putting them on other local units of government. And I think right now, probably the state, with all our financial challenges, we're probably in a better position to actually appropriate some money and pay for it than the counties are to deal with it. So I just would put that out there. I kind of agree with the testifiers. And it's not just Ramsey County, the big counties, it's Bryce County and the smaller counties. Every county has to do this, right? So for some of the smaller counties, it's probably quite burdensome. So, but, you know, again, not a bad idea, but maybe we should pay for it if we want to do it. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Any further discussion? Representative Becker, closing comments?
Yeah, just I think it's important for the state to support our infants and small step forward. Thank you much.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Becker. House File 4289 is laid over.
Okay, the seventh bill we have for consideration is House File 4460. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move House File 4460 to get it before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I would, and I'm going to delay any comments here because we have so many people that have traveled on this bill. It's a scope bill. I think it's the chair's intention to leave this on the table or so we can explore these scope bills. As we know, as a tradition here is to review them for a couple sessions to see what happens. This one definitely is controversial. So I would like to get right to the testifiers.
Yes, so House File 4460 will be laid over. I agree with Representative Hewitt. And so the first testifier will be Jake Eller. Next after Jake will be Robin Finley, and then we'll go from there. So Jake, you go first. You're Jake, yeah. Go for it. It's 90 seconds and we will be strict to it.
Thank you, Chair Becker. My name is Jake Eiler, and I'm an anesthesiologist who's practiced in Minnesota since 2014 and a lifelong Minnesota resident. I am here today as the president of the Minnesota Society of Anesthesiologists, which is an association that represents about 600 anesthesiologists across the state of Minnesota. One of the greatest challenges our society has is ensuring anesthesia access to safe care across Minnesota. Every day, anesthesiologists support a high volume of patients and procedures, and we rely on team-based models throughout Minnesota in order to meet those needs. In Minnesota, besides physicians, the other anesthesia professionals that currently are able to work in this model are certified registered nurse anesthetists, who are valued and important colleagues and members of our teams, and many of them are here today, and many of them are my friends as well. Across the country, another group of highly trained professionals also helps meet this demand, and that's certified anesthesiologist assistants. So CAAs are federally recognized and practice in 22 states, including Wisconsin. They complete rigorous anesthesia-specific training and are designed to work in a medical direction model under the physician anesthesiologist. And this model enables us as a care team warning. To practice safely and care for multiple patients simultaneously to expand our access. Wisconsin, as an example, passed licensure in 2012 and now supports over 200 practicing AAs who provide safe and efficient care. So many CAAs have ties to Minnesota and want to serve in our communities and live in our communities. And this licensure would not change the scope of any existing professionals. Instead, it would add another qualified group to hospitals, surgery centers, and procedural areas. So our Minnesota Society of Anesthesiologists strongly support the licensure for certified anesthesiologist assistants under the Board of Medical Practice so they can join our teams and help our communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Robin is speaking next, and then on deck is Samantha Salmon. So is Robin here?
Robin's right here.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I see Representative Perryman's head, and that's what I saw. Go ahead.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Backer, Chair Bierman, and committee members. My name is Robin Finney, and I'm a certified registered nurse anesthetist and president of the Minnesota Association of Nurse Anesthetists, representing more than 2,300 members statewide. I am here in opposition to House File 4460, which creates a new dependent anesthesia provider role that must be supervised by anesthesiologists. This bill claims to address the anesthesia workforce challenges, but anesthesiology assistants, or AAs, cannot practice without anesthesiologist supervision, and anesthesiologists are concentrated in a handful of our counties. As a result, AAs could only practice where anesthesiologists already are, which is a small part of our state. CRNAs provide the sole anesthesia providers in 97% of our critical access hospitals. This bill offers nothing to those hospitals or those communities. Instead, House File 4460 would allow facilities in Hennepin, Ramsey, Olmsted, Sturms, and St. Louis counties, where anesthesiologists already practice, to substitute master's-prepared AAs for doctoral-prepared CRNAs without improving access to care. And according to our proponent's own questionnaire, this bill does not improve patient outcomes or reduce costs. The question is whether this legislation addresses a real need in our state. Based on the evidence, it does not. MANA respectfully urges the committee to oppose House File 4460. Thank you.
Thank you. Samantha is next. Because of the limited time, we will take four testifiers. We are purposely doing two for, two against. Just so folks know in the audience. So, Samantha, you are on, and then after that will be Leah Gordon. Leah Gordon after Samantha. Go ahead, state your name in 90 seconds, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Samantha Salmon. I'm a certified anesthesiologist assistant, also known as a CAA, and I have been practicing for 13 years. I graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in Biology and completed my pre-medical coursework before earning my Master of Medical Science in Anesthesia, where I completed over 2,000 hours of clinical training. I currently live in St. Paul, but I commute to La Crosse, Wisconsin to work because I am not able to practice in Minnesota. My husband is from the Twin Cities, and we moved back here to raise our family near his extended family. CAAs currently practice in 22 states and Washington, D.C. Licensure of our profession would allow me to work here in Minnesota and would allow other CAAs to return and practice in their home state. It would help address workforce shortages and improve timely access to surgical care for patients across the state. I have previously worked in Washington, D.C. and in Austin, Texas, where I was one of the first CAAs employed by a private practice. I saw firsthand how adding CAAs improves staffing stability, reduce the reliance on costly locum providers, and increase access to anesthesia services for surgeons and patients. I've successfully practiced in multiple states, and there's no reason that CAAs joining the anesthesia care team would not work well here in Minnesota. I respectfully ask for your support of House File 4460. Thank you.
Thank you, Samantha. Leah Gordon, you are next. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Leah Gordon. I'm a CRNA, a nurse anesthesiology program director, and a professor, and I am here to express my opposition to the introduction of anesthesiology assistants in our state. I don't have the authority to question AA contributions within certain models of care in other areas of our country. However, this discussion is not about individual capability. It is about whether an entire model of training and care improves access and safety for Minnesotans. CRNAs deliver the majority of anesthesia care in rural and underserved areas across Minnesota. Before entering anesthesia training, we spend years in high acuity critical care, often more than 5 years or roughly 10,000 hours at the bedside. We then complete 3 years of doctoral education and more than 3,000 hours of hands-on clinical anesthesia training, not training where we train to learn the nursing work, followed by a national board examination which must be passed before we can ever work. This prepares CRNAs to assess, decide, and act independently when patient conditions change. That independence is essential in communities where no other provider is immediately available. When seconds count, patients cannot wait for permission. Minnesota has already evolved beyond physician-dependent anesthesiology models in many settings, and moving towards a model that requires supervision is not innovation, it is a step backwards. At the same time, many CRNAs in Minnesota are not allowed to practice to the full extent of their education and licensure, despite state law allowing it. That is a utilization issue, not a workforce shortage. At its core, it is a question of access. Do we support workforces that can meet patients where they are, or one that cannot? Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt, I'll give you some final words here before we adjourn.
Actually, Mr. Chair, do we have 15 minutes left, or are we done?
We're done. They don't like us to go because we
get
together.
I was just going to say, I think just because this bill is not ready for prime time, as both of us have agreed, and that there is a lot of information the committee needed, I was going to waiver my time to the rest of the testifiers that traveled here. But you have my commitment to work with both sides on this to see if this is something. And I look forward to dialogue from the committee members here to chat with me about this, and I'll try to hook them up with the equivalent sides to what we have to look at. This is definitely a scope bill. I get these for some reason. If anybody wants them, please step forward. I would love to have some more engagement on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill.
Yeah, and I know several people did travel. This is what can happen at times. So I do apologize that you were not heard today, but as Representative Hewitt does, scope bills take a long time. They are important to the health care of Minnesota, and I know Representative Hewitt and others will be continuing to work on it, so your voice will be heard. With that, seeing no further business, that's right, I got to say that we are going to be laying over House File 4460, will be laid over, and with that, seeing no further business, the meeting is adjourned, members. Thank you.